You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
What is the key to creating breakthrough innovation, you ask? Well, today's guest has some insight into that. Drew Boyd is a veteran innovator and the co-author of the book Inside the Box, a proven system of creativity for breakthrough results. That's right. I said inside the box. So we talk about why outside the box actually sets you up to fail, which I couldn't agree more. And in his book and in our discussion, we talk about the five patterns that they've identified in successful innovative products. And here's the part that I think is super cool for launch readers. Those five patterns that they've identified have become ways that you can put innovation into action. So what do you say we go and get inside the box together and get some innovation happening?
Drew, thank you so much for being here today. I'm really looking forward to digging into your expertise and your work.
Great, thanks. Nice to be here with you.
Yeah, this is going to be really interesting. So I want to start, just to make sure we're all on the same page, by asking you to define innovation and creativity from your perspective.
Sure. You know, a lot of people confuse the two. There's no doubt that the two are interrelated. Here's my framework. I look at creativity as the cognitive process. In other words, the stuff that happens in your head to produce an idea. Whereas innovation is what you do with the idea to put it into the marketplace. And so you need to be creative to generate high quality ideas, but that's not enough. There are still a lot of activities that have to go on outside of the idea generation to make the idea come to life.
Do you think that a lot of people or a predominance of people are creative, meaning that, you know, the wheels spin, but they don't actually do something with it? Or do we struggle with both?
I would say people struggle with both. I've had people tell me flat out that they're not creative. Of course, I try to change their life, make them realize that that's certainly not true. But I see highly creative people that just struggle to know what to do with their ideas. And I have very gifted colleagues that are great at implementation, but they're not exactly your go-to people for the idea generation piece. You know, a company, let's face it, they have to be good at both. If I'm pressed, if you said, Drew, which would you rather be great at? I would rather be great at idea generation, because I think it all starts with the great idea. If you're great at implementation, but you have mediocre ideas, guess what you end up with?
Yeah.
A lot of well-executed mediocre ideas. So I encourage my clients to put a premium on the idea of being great at idea generation.
So you said something that I want to dig into more, because I think you and I come very much from the same perspective on this, which is that innovation or creativity are skills anyone can learn. And I could not agree with you more. It drives me crazy when people say, you know, oh, I'm not the creative or the innovative one. Talk to Drew. He's the one with the blue streak in his hair and the funky shirt and the cool glasses. And I'm looking at your photo, though, by the way, which is not what you look like for those out there. But
thanks,
that is... That's right. My pleasure. But that's, you know, kind of what I hear from people a lot. But what you say is that everybody can learn this. So tell us more about that.
Sure. And it's such a common stereotype and mystique about creative people and creative spaces. I'll go to an advertising agency and they look so hip and cool. They have bicycles hanging off the
ceiling. Ping pong tables.
Yeah, ping pong tables. Everybody has slinkies and they're all just dressed really hip and cool. And it's such a a stereotype that I hate. I just hate that. And what because it continues to spread this myth about the creative genius, and that's just not the case. Creativity and innovation, there's skills that can be learned like any other skill, whether it's a skill in business such as marketing or accounting, or something in your personal life like learning play an instrument or a new game or something. And I find people are so surprised to hear this. When I stand in front of audiences and say this to people, their heads turn just right away out of sheer doubt. And until, of course, I put them through a series of exercises where they see that generating ideas in a systematic way is, in fact, possible. And it's, you know, it's an epiphany for people. They just they just their eyes light up. I know the look when I see this. And I've had the great fortune to be able to teach creativity to people from, you know, CEOs of major companies all the way down to third graders and everybody in between. So trust me when I tell you, creativity is a skill.
So is there something that our Launch Street listeners can do right now, an exercise like the ones you're talking about? I'm assuming you're talking about when you're keynoting or kind of running a meeting like that. Is there something our listeners can do to so you can put them through that test so their eyes can go wide and they can be sprinkled the magic innovation and creativity dust?
Well, I will tell you, yes, I'll tell you the exercise I put people through within the first 2 or 3 minutes of a keynote. I have people pick any product, just something around them. So, for example, I was with a group of people recently, and the person picked a bottle of water that happened to be sitting in front of them. But then what I tell them next is very surprising. I said, I want them to take that product and make one change to it. Mm-hmm. But they have to make one change to the product that makes it worse, that makes it horrible, absolutely ruins it. And, of course, everybody smiles and they're waiting for the big surprise. They think I'm going to tell them to try to improve the product. And what I actually tell them to do is make it horrible. So this particular individual imagined a bottle of water that was muddy and dirty. And everybody started laughing and joking about it. But then is when I really surprised them. And I said, now I want you to take that ruined product and do the following. You have to find a way to sell it. In other words, I want you to find a way to take this seemingly absurd product and envision ways to make it valuable in the marketplace. And at first, people are shocked by this. Like, oh my God, that's impossible. You can't do that. But as I push them and as I make them work through this cognitive condition we call fixedness, this person was able to envision things and started saying things like, well, for example, imagine this is a test bottle of water, maybe from a certain river that could be used in research. Or maybe it's has a certain kind of germs in it or dirt in it for people that are going to be in that kind of climate or environment where they have to let their body become accustomed to this type of water. Or this water is used for nutrients for plants, for people who love their plants. It becomes a gourmet food for plants. And so this person who at first had this seemingly stupid, ruined product, all of a sudden was able to envision many valuable ideas. And this is the important part of this method that we're going to talk about today, how you're able to take essentially a solution that doesn't have a use at first and work backwards to the problem that it solves, exactly backwards than the traditional view of creativity. And it turns out humans are actually better at that direction. And so I love it when I put people through that simple exercise. We call it the ruined product exercise. And I encourage your listeners to try it. They'll surprise themselves how fluid they are to take even the most absurd thing and find some valuable use for it somewhere.
So is the magic in there that making it worse first? Because I'm intrigued by that. My mouth is a little bit agape of like, huh, let me think through this. I mean, is that because, I mean, we're, you know, with innovation, to your point, we're so used to saying, how do you improve? How do you improve? And that's a lot of pressure. And sure, to your point, it's a harder thing to get to sometimes. Is that magic in making it worse? Does that open up the floodgates of innovation in a way that you yep. can't get to by making it better first?
Exactly. And so what this little exercise does is multiple things. First of all, it proves to them that they're able to work backwards from the even the absurd configuration back to its benefit. And secondly, it helps them confront this condition I alluded to earlier just a minute ago called fixedness. Cognitive fixedness is a bias that makes it very difficult for us to imagine yeah. other configurations than what we're used to. Water is not supposed to be dirty. Well, that's fixedness. And when you're able to envision a corrupted bottle of water or dirty bottle of water, something that breaks fixedness, and then find a benefit, well, guess what? You just did the creative act. The act of creation is the sudden collision of two previously unrelated themes. And so what I teach people then is once they realize they can take something even absurd and make it valuable, then I teach them a set of techniques on how to create these so-called absurdities, these hypothetical solutions that even seem bizarre at first, and then work backwards to a benefit. That's the creative act as I teach it. And as we'll talk about in a minute, these patterns are extremely powerful to get to people to places that they wouldn't be able to get to on their own.
Yeah. And I just, for launch readers out there listening, I hope you just take a second, pause this podcast and actually go do that exercise. I'm sitting here thinking about all the things I could do it with. My car, the snow globe in front of me. Like I've got a million things now on my list that I'm going to play with this later today. But for Launch Street listeners, go do this. I think you're going to amaze yourself the way kind of Drew just talked about and shows his audiences to do. And Drew, I have to imagine that, you know, when you've got a group of people, whether they're in the same organization or maybe they came together from different organizations and then went back, that ups the innovation game of the whole company. I mean, one of the things I firmly believe is that for a company or team to be innovative, everyone has to participate. It's not something that, you know, I get to do in my silo over here. But if you can unlock that in people, I've got to imagine that everybody elevates with them.
Innovation's a team sport.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. And what this this method does is allows everybody to play. It democratizes innovation. And that's important, because one of the huge mistakes companies make is they silo innovation. They create this, you know, chief innovation officer or, you know, department of innovation. And that sends a terrible signal to the rest of the organization that, hey, we've got this.
And you're not innovative, by the way.
You can stay out of our way. Right. You're not innovative. We got this. So I encourage companies not to do that and to make innovation just a regular routine skill and put it into the culture like you would quality or ethics, right, or productivity or leadership. Just look at it as an imperative that affects everybody. And companies are going to get themselves further along faster with that mindset.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. You know, one of the things that you shun is part of the reason why I really wanted to interview you was this phrase that I think we hear a lot from leaders, and that's that, all right, guys, we have to think outside the box. And I know listeners out there are probably, you know, moving their lips with me because they know what I'm going to say the minute I say think, right? It's, we hear it all the time as this, you know, innovation imperative. But you actually say that that's wrong and that you should go inside the box. So my first question to you is, why is that whole notion of outside the box so misleading?
Okay, well, here's the story that most people don't know. Where that phrase comes from. That phrase was coined in the 1970s by a researcher named P.J. Guilford, and it's based on research he did with a famous puzzle that I'm willing to bet most, if not all, of your listeners have seen before. It's called the nine-dot puzzle, and it's where you make three rows of three dots that form a square. And the task is to draw four straight lines connecting all nine dots without lifting your pencil. And it's hard, unless you know the secret. And the secret, for, again, many of your listeners know this, you have to draw your lines outside the box created by the nine dots, and that gives you the right angle to complete the puzzle. And so Guilford, when he administered this puzzle to people, only 20% could solve it. So he said, oh, it was obvious that people have to think outside the box to be more creative.
Ah.
Well, that's where it comes from.
I had no idea.
Yeah. But Tamara, here's the problem. Two other researchers right after Guilford did the exact same study he did, but added a second group where they were given the answer to the puzzle ahead of time. In the first group, just like Guilford's results, only 20% could solve the puzzle. But guess what happened in the second group, the ones that had the answer?
Well,
you would think they would do much better, right? No, 20%.
They were too far outside the box. They couldn't get back in.
They couldn't get back in. And here's what's true. Here's why I rail against this notion. What are you really saying to somebody when you tell them to think outside the box? What it does is you send the person's mind outside in this vast, unconstrained space. And what the mind suffers is what we call idea chaos or idea anarchy. You end up sending the mind in this wild cognitive goose chase looking for an idea. And it stymies the person and frustrates the person. And what we know through research and through experience is that when you confine people inside the box, you form tightly bound constraints. The constraints force the mind to work harder and smarter. Many people think constraints are a barrier to creativity, when just the opposite is true. When you form constraints and force yourself to ideate within those constraints, you're going to be much more creative. So let's go back to our example with the bottled water. When I did this exercise with this person, I've essentially constrained them to one product, one configuration, and one task. I even gave them time limits. I only gave them 2 minutes to do this exercise. And you know what? After he came up with all these great ideas where he didn't think he was going to be able to, but in fact did, he looked at me and he says, you know, Drew, with all those constraints around me, I felt so free. And I've heard that a lot from people. The constraints actually free up the mind, not shut the mind down. It's a fascinating conundrum for people, but they have to experience it for themselves, and then they believe it forever.
Do you think that's because in that, you know, that vastness of possibility, there's just, you know, it's almost like spinning through space, you know, in the movies, you see them kind of out of control. There's just nothing to hold on to, nothing for the mind to say, all right, I'm going to clip in here and right. then keep going.
Exactly. So what happens is the mind clips on to something that it knows. You end up going and gravitating to the ideas you've already had. It's very hard for people to come up with an original idea that they've never had before. Yeah. And this is why just unconstrained brainstorming has been shown with over 50 years of research not to work. I'm sorry. I hope people don't want to shoot the messenger, but brainstorming does not just go out and read the literature. But you nailed it. That's exactly what happens. The mind just is on a slippery slope and really can't get the traction it needs to generate ideas.
Well, you know, I mean, brainstorming, we could probably do a whole nother podcast on why that doesn't work. Because, I mean, there's so many layers to that challenge with brainstorming. There's groupthink. There's people like me who dominate a conversation. You know, there's a lot of issues there. But, you know, the other thing, too, is I'd love your perspective on this. You know, I talk a little bit about rearranging the box when I do innovation work. And, you know, kind of, I think, similar to your inside the box, but whatever phrase we use, you also have to deal with the realities around you. And I find that the whole, you know, think outside the box, people then are detached from the resources they really have, the time constraints they really have, the needs of the marketplace that are really there. So whatever they do bring back, if they clip on and bring back, ends up not being as relevant because it really wasn't built on the house that exists.
Hey, it doesn't make sense to generate ideas that violate the constraints. The constraints are real, so the ideas have to be real. And that's why people are so much more effective when we put constraints around them. In fact, any client that I work with, one of the first questions I'll ask them is, what are the constraints? And I've had clients look at me and say, oh, no, Drew, we don't want any constraints. We want to consider all possibilities. Yeah. You know what I say to them? I say to them, no constraints, no project. because think about it. Why would I set up myself for failure with the constraints? With constraints, I know I'm going to be successful. I had a client once call me. He's the head of a large aerospace division for a company. And he said, hey, Drew, I'm meeting with all my employees tomorrow, big town hall meeting, 600 people. He goes, here's what I want to say to them. I want to say, hey, imagine next year you had all the money and all the manpower and all the headcount, everything you needed, what would you do to create growth? And he goes, Drew, what do you think? And I said, no. I said, here's what I want you to say. I want you to say to them, imagine next year you had no money, no headcount, no resources. Now what would you do to produce growth? So which approach is going to produce more original and creative ideas? Clearly the second approach. Yeah. And that's exactly what he did. Well, constraints matter.
And I think they do. I think you're absolutely right. And I love the way you kind of frame it up. Is they not only matter, but they are food for innovation or ingredients for innovation if you use them correctly. And, you know, it's funny about the leader you were talking about, who has obviously very good intent of trying to get people to push the boundaries. But the reality is, to what you said earlier, not all ideas are going to work. So what's the point?
Exactly. And this is where in brainstorming sessions, and oh boy, I'm tempted here to not go down this path.
Don't worry, I'll get on the soapbox with you. It won't be pretty,
but you'll bring me back. You know, what happens in brainstorming sessions is that people will come up with a well-intentioned idea and everybody gets excited about it. But there's usually one person in the room who sits back and they know in their heart that the idea will never work. Maybe they have the technical expertise or something. They know it doesn't work. It'll never work. But they don't say anything in the room. And they don't say anything in the room for two reasons. One is they don't want to be the Debbie Downer, you know, that
yeah, then you're the yes but person.
So they sit in silence. But the other reason is even more practical. They don't need to say anything. They know that the organizational antibodies will gobble that idea up eventually and it'll go away. But in the meantime, all these people got enthusiastic and excited about this great idea and it doesn't go anywhere. And then they're soured on the idea of innovation and gee, our company doesn't do anything. And this is where traditional brainstorming it just doesn't work. And people have made efforts to improve it. And I agree that some improvements will get some better results. But this is where I think a more systematic method where you work within constraints that already exist is going to be so much more productive and efficient for people.
Yeah, I think the other challenge I find with the brainstorming is you're not actually given time to analyze. So you can't innovate and analyze at the same time. So they try to do it all at once in one session. And you need time to think about it too, to figure out what are the constraints that would hinder this or would solve this. But without the time to do that, and everything happens at that, I always laugh. It's the 3 p.m. brainstorm with the scented markers and the blank easel pad. That's what it looks like.
Exactly.
So let's keep digging. I think we could probably go on about brainstorms, but I am with you. So let's talk about what we can do to drive innovation forward. And you co-authored a book, Inside the Box, A Proven System of Creativity for Breakthrough Results. Is there a favorite tool in there that can help us be inside the box and be innovative?
Sure. So this book is based on the research by my co-author, Jacob Goldenberg. And Jacob did a fascinating thing for his PhD research. He studied highly innovative products initially to find out what made them different from one another. And what he found instead is that products have more in common with one another. They tend to follow a set of patterns. Mm-hmm. And so these patterns can be reapplied to anything, a product, a process, a service. Think of the patterns as a way to essentially channel your ideation for you. They guide your brain to these crazy configurations, like I talked about before, the dirty bottle water. And so in those patterns, and believe it or not, the majority of innovative products in the world can be explained by just 5 patterns. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis of our book. Do I have a favorite one? Well, that's like asking a parent if they have a favorite child. let's put it this way. They're all wonderful. They all do unique things. I'll tell you the one that I tend to go to a lot, and so does my wife, by the way. She's been trained, and God love her. She started in our relationship, I would admit, not very creative. Even she would admit it. And today, she's one of the most amazingly creative people I know. She tends to use what we call the division technique. And division is when you take a product or a problem or a service or anything, and you cut it in half or divide it along some physical or virtual sense, and then rearrange it in some way. And so a lot of interesting products in the world are created with the division technique. And it's just for her, it's become kind of her go-to thing. She can solve anything. And she does it typically with the division technique. It's really a powerful, like they all are, but this one in particular is very powerful.
How about we do this? How about we go through all 5 and maybe you can share with us some examples that we would recognize in our everyday lives from each of them and kind of what makes it that pattern?
Sure. So let's go through them. Now, they sound a little mathematical, but they're not. So let me warn you up front. The first one is called subtraction. Subtraction is when you remove an essential element, something that you thought had to be there, and now all of a sudden it's gone. And so just think of something like a condensed soup or powdered soup. Mm. What's been removed? Well, the water. And first, you would think water would be essential, but once it's been removed, you have this much more convenience of powdered soup. Or removing the frames on a pair of glasses, what does it yield you? Contact lenses. Mm. So that's the subtraction technique. Next is multiplication. Multiplication is when you take a component of a product, you make a copy of it, but change it in some qualitative way. So a simple example would be like bifocal glasses, right? You have the main lens, but you also then have a smaller lens within. Mm. That's the multiplication technique. cameras have a lot of multiplication in them. Take an iPhone, for example. It has a camera on the front and a camera on the back. That is pure and simple multiplication. The next technique, the third one, we call task unification. Task unification is defined as taking a component and giving it an additional job, something it wasn't intended to do at first. It has its original job, but now it has this additional job. And so one of my favorites is a feature on cars made by the car maker Nissan. They have this thing called the Easy Fill Tire Alert, right? And so when you're filling your tires with air, what happens is when you reach the correct pressure, the horn goes beep, beep, to let you know that you reached the right pressure. Isn't that a great idea?
Yeah,
every time I tell that story, it's such a simple idea, but classic task unification. The next technique is division. That's where you divide a component or the product itself and put it somewhere else into the system. And here's a simple example, a drone, right? A drone has divided out the pilot and placed the pilot on the ground.
Oh.
Or something even more familiar to people is the remote control of a TV. Anytime a control system has been taken off the main unit and put somewhere else, like a thermostat, for example, that's the division technique. And finally is what we call attribute dependency. And this is the tricky one. It's number one, it's the most powerful. Let's put it this way. It explains the majority of innovative products. It's when one thing changes as something else changes, a dependency, a correlation has been created between two attributes. So, for example, transition sunglasses, right? As the light outside gets dark, the lens gets lighter and vice versa. Or the windshield wipers on your car, right? As they speed up, they slow down depending on the amount of rain. And if you look around you right now, I would tell your listeners, look around, they'll see things immediately around them that have this pattern inside of it, this ability to change as something else changes. It's a very, very common pattern. So those are the five techniques, and those are what help guide your thinking to create these what we call virtual products, these crazy things at first that all of a sudden you're able to make sense of. They're fabulous.
So a lot of these, when you were doing the research and when you think about kind of innovation out in the world, particularly the more disruptive innovation, things that really shift a category in some way, and I'm thinking about things like Cirque du Soleil, you know, which changed circuses or our definition of circuses. Or is it Cirque? I don't know what the plural is. Circuses, I'm not sure there. We have out here in Colorado a winery called Infinite Monkey Urban Winery, and it's wine in cans. He was the first one to do that in single serve cans, and he changed the category. When you think about those, I mean, I would love for you to apply those to this so our listeners can really grab a hold of, oh, this is how I think about this.
Well, one of the common questions is, what about Uber or what about Airbnb? You know, those are real category killers. And so you think about, in that case, we would look at the task unification pattern. Task unification is when you assign an additional job to an existing resource, something in the immediate environment. Your car. Yep. Your car all of a sudden has its original job of carrying you around, but now the ride-sharing ability gives it this additional function, and voila, you've just created Uber. And same with Airbnb. That business model can be explained with the task unification technique. So what's true is that here's the real story about the patterns is that we're not here to claim that every invention in the world was created with these five patterns. We're saying the majority. And the reason is for thousands of years, everyday innovators have used these patterns in their inventions, usually without even realizing it. And these patterns are now embedded into the products and services you see around you every day. And so what mankind has done is they continue to go back to these patterns consciously or unconsciously to invent products. Occasionally, do products get invented without the patterns? Of course they do. But what Jacob's research shows is that a product that's been invented with one of these patterns has a much higher chance of success in the marketplace than a invention that was not invented with the patterns. And that's why we get really excited about them.
So this might be a naive question, but why is that?
You know, I wish I knew. I think, and we're starting to look at some ways to reach this, is that humans have come to encounter and trust these products, these configurations. So when somebody you know, my mother, 87 years old, God love her, she gets the idea of attribute dependency, right? I could explain it to her all day. I don't need to. When she looks at transition sunglasses or windshield wipers, people have come to become trusting and familiar with products that are smart, that things that changes and adapt as once something else changes. And so what I think happens is that innately we've learned to trust and accept and use these products. So when other ones come around that have that pattern in them, subconsciously, we tend to abide by it or trust it or at least embrace it. We don't have proof of that, but that if you ask me the question, that's how I would answer it.
And, you know, I want to link this back to our earlier part of our conversation about, you know, creativity or innovation can be structured and systematic. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm envisioning that you can use these five patterns as you've laid them out when you're stuck in a rut or when you can't figure out how to overcome a challenge or when you're trying to innovate and you're trying the brainstorming blue skies method and it's not working. Take a step back and try these five patterns and say, what would I subtract from this? How would I divide this? How would I multiply this, et cetera?
Here's the trick, though. The key is not to say, hey, I've got this problem. Which pattern can I use? The trick is to build constraints around the problem, a boundary. Let's put it a boundary around the problem. Then systematically apply one or two of the techniques that will alter it in some way to help you see some new benefit. It'll help you break fixedness. So, for example, one of my clients is a large industrial company based in Europe. They make hoses, okay, just everyday hoses, right? Hoses like a garden hose. In this case, these are hoses that you would see in a factory, for example. They connect pieces of equipment. And they were desperate to innovate these things because they're getting a lot of competition. They're becoming a commodity. And so we applied one round of the division technique where we took the hose and we cut it down the middle. Just imagine it being cut down the middle. Didn't know why. Just what we do at first is you make the application of the technique, and then you answer the question, what would it be good for? And just this one application of division, they created a hose that does this. First of all, it won't kink. And kinking is terrible in a factory because it shuts down the production line.
It's terrible in my backyard too.
It's terrible in your backyard too. But this is a 450-year-old company that had never considered a hose other than a shaped round. Mm. And now all of a sudden, in one application of division, they've invented a hose that is not round. It's in a different shape, but it won't kink. And that's a huge selling point. The other technique we applied was task unification, where we took functions in the factory and placed them inside the hose. Now you have hoses that do things like heat up material or cool it off or filter it or mix it or analyze it. And you've added value to these hoses. They're not just connecting devices anymore, right? They're not just carriers. Yeah. They're actually processors. And you've brought up the price point. You brought up the value. You've re-energized the business. You've taken something that was essentially a commodity that's been around for, you know, forever. How long have hoses been around, for God's sakes? And turn it into something that is more value to the company and the customer.
You know, Drew, what I so appreciate about your story, and I hope Launch Readers, you're hearing this, is you don't have to be Apple, Google, Airbnb, you know, the sexy, cool, on the cover, fast company, industry or product or service to be innovative and to do this. It's hoses. I had another interview I was doing last week, and it was mats that robots and humans actually stand on, I guess. So, you know, I love those stories about hoses because it's just the opposite of what you expect, but there's so much room for innovation in any category.
And so we're two things to that. Number one, we're convinced Apple uses these patterns. They're very secretive and they won't answer our questions. But
all you have to do is look at their products.
And, you know, it's funny. You don't really need the voice of the company or the voice of the customer. Instead, look at the voice of the product. And that was the title of Jacob's original research, The Voice of the Product. Imagine you could interview a product and it could tell you all its secrets, and what these secrets would be are these patterns. And so we don't need to have Apple tell us. All we have to do is look at its products and we can spot the patterns. For example, my final exam for my graduate students, one of the questions is to take a smartphone and they have to find as many of the five patterns and as many examples of each of the patterns as they can in a smartphone. And once they are trained, it's child's play. I mean, those patterns are just all over, all through smartphones. So it's a skill I call pattern spotting. But back to your main point, yeah, this isn't just for the sexy Silicon Valley company. This is for companies that make hoses and mats and tires and, you know, cheese and anything else.
I don't want to say flip gears, but kind of go off a little bit off on tangent and ask you a question, because, you know, innovation is one of those things that is so helpful, I think, particularly in, you know, hyper-fast competitive times, which one could argue is always the case, but it certainly feels that way now. But when you think about the business challenges when you think about the challenges facing business today, what are those big things and how can innovation help?
Well, the number one imperative for all companies is growth, whether they tell you that or not. It is growth. Any stockholder, whether you're privately held or publicly traded, growth in the value of the company is what creates wealth. And so it's hard. It's a constant pressure. Imagine you're a company like GE, and you want to grow just 6% a year. Well, that's like creating a company the size of Nike every
year.
Right,
that's huge.
Yeah, right. So what they end up doing is they end up buying their problem away. They go out and acquire companies, and it's just not a good idea. I've been in mergers and acquisition with a large healthcare company, the company known as Johnson & Johnson, and acquisition is acknowledging basically you don't have the internal ability to innovate on your own. And so I preach to companies to use those resources instead, that, you know, instead of overpaying for these acquisitions, why instead do you not just turn those resources in and learn organically to innovate on your own? So growth is the biggest challenge, because eventually you run out of market share, you run out of even M&A opportunities. You've got to organically innovate if you're going to sustain growth in the short term and long term. So that's number one for sure.
So, you know, you had mentioned that the acquisition could be a mistake because you're really not nurturing those internal innovation skills and resource and opportunities that are probably right in front of you if you actually just look at things a little bit differently. What are some of the other mistakes you've seen with these organizations when they call you? You know, what mistakes are they making around their innovation efforts? The things we should be avoiding.
Yeah, I alluded to the one before, creating the chief innovation officer. That's not a good idea, you know, Office of Innovation. The other one, though, is just failing to see innovation as a skill. They need to see it as something that can be trained, and they need to staff to it and invest in it, just like they would invest in training around other topics, quality, ethics, for example. That's number one. I think the other mistake that companies make is they tend to believe in the lone wolf, you know, the lone genius, where in fact innovation is going to be better when you have diverse cross-functional teams. We saw this over and over at my previous company, J&J, and now I see this with our clients. So we coach a lot on how to create what we call the innovation dream team, right? How you create those teams that are going to move you forward. And once companies are able to make those small changes and investments, they get themselves on the right path. I'm not saying it's going to happen overnight, but you got to start somewhere. And starting with what I would consider maybe just a low-level pilot program is a great way to get started, just to dip your toe in the water. And then find out your cadence. What is your cadence for innovation? How often do you do it? When do you need to do it? How does it fit into the rest of the business cycle? Who's responsible for it? How does it flow through the organization? And the great companies are the ones that have figured that out and make innovation routine.
You know, one of the things I think we hear a lot about is with large organizations is, you know, the fear of failure. And then you always hear the flip side of that, which is, you know, you have to embrace failure. You have to love your failures, which I always think is a little bit of a, I don't know, silly statement, because you don't have to love them, but you have to live with them or at least learn from them. But I'm curious from your perspective where that fits in, because oftentimes it seems like part of the reason we end up with chief innovation officers and, you know, it being siloed to the cool people in the funky garage or the lone innovator is because people are so afraid of that kind of, it's so elusive and the fear factor is so high.
Yeah, so my answer may surprise everyone here. The failure mantra is one that I too get a little tired of hearing.
Yeah.
Fail real fast and all this other crazy stuff. What's missing for me is the rest of the equation, and it's what we call in the education and business, we call it action learning. Action learning is a cycle. Let me walk through it. Action learning dictates that you do the following. You take an action, you reflect on what actually happened, you ask yourself why the difference from what you thought was going to happen, and then step four is, what are you going to do about it next time? So embedded in there is that failure message. But unless you go through that four-stage process of learning, that is really what adult learning is, and continuous improvement. And by the way, it should be a way of life for people. And you get to my age and my point of my career, and I still embrace this. This is a way of thinking that, by the way, started in the military. This is what the military does after any military action. They do these four steps. Why did you do this? What did you expect to happen? Why the difference? What are you going to do about it next time? And this is what keeps people alive, right? Without this learning. So same with innovation. You know, embrace failure. That's fine, but embrace the other three parts too. Take an action. What actually happened? You know, embrace your successes. It's failures is just one minus the total activity. There's a whole side of it that embraces successes as well. So look at the total picture. Don't just get so hyper about the failures themselves as the only ways to learn.
Well, and you know, you said something kind of quickly, but I think it's so important. So I want to just say it one more time about what's the difference between the expectation and what happened. I think that's the part we often miss.
That's the piece.
Yeah. It is so easy to overlook that and not take a step back and say, okay, I wanted to go here, but I ended up here. So how did that happen? What was the difference there? That gap is where to me is where the knowledge and insight is. So I just wanted to take a second and pull that out as the thing that I think we often miss.
Yeah, that's the gold.
Yeah, the gold.
If people take nothing away from this interview, it's that reflection is such a key piece to success in life.
Well, Drew, I doubt that they're only taking that away because I took notes today. And I always love an interview where I actually take notes of things that I learned along the way too. Actually, I do with every interview, but it's so good when I take notes. So we could keep going, but we are unbelievably out of time. So where can people go to first get your book and then also to connect with you? And we'll put the links in the show notes.
Sure. So the easiest is www.drewboyd.com. You'll see some videos of me there and a lot of resources, access to video courses. You'll also find where my book is. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, et cetera. And I'm also available on LinkedIn. I'm very active in LinkedIn and Twitter. So I would love to connect with people.
Just out of curiosity, for your online courses, we don't have to go into depth on them, but who is right for those? Is that entrepreneurs, leaders? Who should go for those?
You know, there really are a set of courses that I've created that are right for various levels, CMOs, chief strategists, all the way down to first line people in any organization. So we try to make a layers of courses that's going to help people depending on where they are in the organization.
Got it. Last question for you. What's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? Hobby, passion, experience.
I make acoustic guitars.
Oh.
And I do it professionally, and I make handmade, highly creative, innovative acoustic guitars. I play guitar, but my passion really is making them, in addition to everything else I'm doing. So.
With all that time in the day. Do you sell them custom? Do you sell them in retail?
I sell them custom.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And so, it's fun. And what I do is I apply the SIT patterns, the patterns we just talked about, to create one-of-a-kind, unique innovations inside guitars.
I love it. Putting your own ideas to work. That's how you know that there's actually some validity in all this. Drew, thank you so much. This was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.